The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of drugwarfacts.org. We're going to hear about how marijuana legalization is and isn't working. We're going to hear about the border wall that's been proposed by the current president. But first, as I'm recording these words, William Barr is on the first day of his Senate confirmation hearing. Barr was nominated to be the new U.S. Attorney General. He previously worked as Attorney General under George H.W. Bush. Several organizations working on drug policy reform, civil rights, and social justice have issued statements opposing Barr's nomination. Some of those groups, including the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights and the Drug Policy Alliance, held a news teleconference on the nomination on January 10th. We're going to hear parts of that news conference now. Michael Collins is director at the Drug Policy Alliance's Office of National Affairs in Washington, D.C., where he works with Congress on a wide variety of drug policy issues, including drug war spending, syringe access funding, appropriations, and Latin America. Michael was one of the speakers on that teleconference. Let's hear from him now.
Hi, everyone. This is Michael Collins. Great to be on the call. Drug Policy Alliance is the leading organization fighting to end the war on drugs. After the nightmare we had with Jeff Sessions as Attorney General, many of us felt that we couldn't go much lower. But William Barr certainly gives Jeff Sessions a run for his money in terms of his desire to pursue the war on drugs. With Sessions, we faced challenges to marijuana legalization, sentencing reform, and an incarceration-only approach to an overdose crisis that is demonstrably a public health issue. Our fear is that we will have the same problems with Barr. This is someone who was Attorney General during the expansion of the war on drugs in the early 90s, who pushed to fill prisons and was partly responsible for the mass incarceration mess we have today. It's very unlikely that he's changed his mind since the 1990s, not least because he signed on to a letter in 2015 opposing a modest sentencing reform bill, the Sentencing Reform and Corrections Act, in which he claimed, quote, "our system of justice is not broken," unquote. The most frustrating thing is that many advocates, ourselves included, spent a lot of time and energy passing a criminal justice reform bill, the First Step Act, which Trump signed into law in late December last year. Much of that legislation has to be implemented by the Attorney General, and putting Barr in that position raises questions about whether this administration ever really cared about criminal justice reform. This is like if President Obama passed healthcare reform, then appointed Ted Cruz as Secretary of HHS. The fox will be guarding the hen house, and that's a real problem. On overdose issues, the consensus politically has been that we need a public health approach to this crisis. Yet Barr is someone who has the same mindset as Sessions and is likely to pursue the same failed drug war strategies of locking up drug users and pushing for tough sentences that do nothing to reduce overdose deaths and serve only to increase the prison population, usually through the incarceration of people of colour. Indeed, William Barr's daughter, Mary Daly, is currently the point person on opioid prosecutions at the Department of Justice, and she has stressed the importance of, quote, "aggressive enforcement," unquote, when it comes to the overdose crisis. It's also very Trumpian to have the father and daughter working in the same agency. In a 2001 interview, Barr also seemed to call for the extrajudicial killing of drug traffickers. Here's the quote, open quote, "using the military and drugs was always under discussion. I personally was of the view it was a national security problem. I personally likened it to terrorism. I believe you can use law enforcement to some extent, particularly in the US, but the best thing to do is not to extradite Pablo Escobar and bring him to the United States and try him. That's not the most effective way of destroying that organization," close quote. My conclusion here is that he's advocating for extrajudicial killings, which is deeply troubling, especially given that Trump himself has already called for the death penalty for people who sell drugs like fentanyl. The last thing I'll say is that Sessions was given an easy ride by Republicans during his Senate confirmation process. It was early in the Trump administration. He was a former senator, so he got no tough questions from Republicans. He then had very public spats with Senator Grassley over his opposition to criminal justice reform, Senator Gardner with Colorado fought with him about his position on marijuana legalization, even though we knew before the hearings that Jeff Sessions held these odious positions. Our hope is that in these hearings, Senate Republicans step up and hold Barr accountable on these and other issues, rather than giving him a free pass. They have a constitutional obligation to advise and consent, and they should take that role seriously this time around. Thank you.
That was Michael Collins, director at the Drug Policy Alliance's Office of National Affairs, speaking on a news teleconference with representatives from several other social justice and civil rights organizations. They were discussing their opposition to the nomination of William Barr as the next U.S. Attorney General. Barr is a horrible choice for Attorney General. But the Republican majority is determined to push this nomination down our throats. So there is a chance that by the time you hear me speak these words, dear listener, Barr may already have the job. God save the Republic. If those votes haven't been taken, please contact your senators. Tell them to oppose the nomination of William Barr. You are listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of DrugWarFacts.org. Let's stick with the current administration for a bit. Unless you've been hiding in a cave for the past few years, and if there's a vacancy in a nearby cave, please let me know. You will know that the person currently occupying the Oval Office has proclaimed his wish that we should build a border fence between the U.S. and Mexico. A wall. Donnie's folly. It really is a fence, whatever you want to call it, but this administration, in reality... Where was I? Oh, yes. Donnie's folly. The border wall. The fence. A lot of people are skeptical about this idea, and for very good reasons. Leaving aside the more basic question of whether this will ever be more than a jingoistic rallying cry, it just won't stop anything. In particular, it's not going to stop the flow of drugs, guns, and money over that border. It's a bad, dumb idea. And next up, we're going to hear from San Ho Tree about just how bad an idea it is. San Ho Tree is a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and the director of their Drug Policy Project. He's a longtime social justice and drug policy reform advocate. He's a good friend of the program, and San Ho is also one of my very best friends. He presented a webinar recently on the border wall and the drug war. We're going to hear a portion of that now. Here's San Ho.
On the issue of drug policy, Donald Trump, of course, has argued for a wall. That's why we're having a shutdown right now. But it's important to remember where this wall idea came from and why it's so absurd that we're having this shutdown right now. It's important to remember that the wall, the concept of build a wall, and it came as a mnemonic device to help Donald Trump remember to talk about the issue of immigration. Specifically, his advisors were worried that he wouldn't include immigration amongst his talking points. So they said, and this is between Steve Bannon, Sam Nunberg, and one of his other staffers. So Josh Green, the journalist at Business Week, first published this in his book, Devil's Bargain. This came out in 2017. Last week, you might recall the New York Times did a similar story about the origins of the Trump wall, but it's important to give credit where it's due. So this comes from his book, Devil's Bargain. So it's Roger Stone, Steve Bannon, and Sam Nunberg talking about the idea of a wall. And at first, Donald Trump kind of didn't go for the idea. He didn't think it was that good. But then he tested it out at an audience in Iowa, and people went nuts for it. And then he embellished it. You know, they make Mexico pay for it. More racism, more humiliation heaped on top of that. Becomes a very popular talking point during his campaign. And so he's pledged this hundreds of times, both on Twitter and live in front of audiences, that he's going to build this wall and Mexico is going to pay for it. Well, his mouth is writing checks that Congress can't possibly cash or appropriate. And so we are now at this level of a shutdown. But it's important to put into context what is actually happening at the border. There is no crisis at the border. If you look at apprehension rates of immigrants, migrants, they're at record lows or near record lows, or literally back down to about 1970 levels today. And so where is this crisis coming from? It's largely a political tool by the administration. At the same time, we've had Border Patrol personnel ramped up. And so the situation is as well controlled as it's ever been. But again, we have these racist talking points from the administration. So when they talk about a border wall, we already have hundreds of miles of fencing. And Trump now wants to build more fencing. Originally, he said it would be a solid concrete wall, 30 feet tall. And then Border Patrol convinced him, sir, we need some transparency. We need to be able to see if people are amassing on the other side. So it's got to be a semi-transparent wall with slats. So Trump, a month or two ago, began talking about slats. It's going to be a slatted wall, which is what we currently have, by the way. But what's the problem with slats? Well, number one, you can't build a solid wall in the middle of a desert, for instance. Google desert flash flood, if you're not familiar with the power of water and what happens when you have basically a mini tsunami in the middle of a desert, when it hits an immovable object like a wall, a solid wall. You can imagine what kind of destruction that would wreak on a wall. And also, you don't want sand building up on one side of it and creating a giant sand dune where people can just walk over the wall, kind of defeats the purpose of a wall. So therefore, you've got slats. And as soon as we put up these slats, well, we've got 4-inch gaps in the wall. That's enough to stop people from crossing through the wall. But traffickers adapted fairly quickly. When you have a 4-inch gap in your wall, what's the first countermeasure they came up with? 3 3/4-inch drug size packages that you can literally pass through the wall. Now, you might not be able to pass tons and tons of drugs through the wall that way. It's not that efficient. But we're in an era of the fentanyl crisis. And fentanyl is far more compact than heroin. This is a semi-problematic graphic, but it gives you a rough sense of the power of these drugs. So if fentanyl, if morphine is one dose, heroin is twice as powerful as morphine. Fentanyl is about 50 times more powerful than heroin or 100 times more powerful than morphine. And then carfentanil, which is elephant tranquilizer, it's not used for humans, but it's also turning up in our heroin supply. That's far, far, far more potent than anything. So that's, we're talking about tiny, tiny, amounts of drugs that are necessary to produce the same effect. So when you have a dose of fentanyl being about the equivalent of a couple of grains of sand, and you have 4-inch gaps in the wall, that wall is not up to the task of stopping that flow of drugs. But let's forget about fentanyl. Let's say this wall, was built. Well, again, the traffickers came up with early countermeasures for that as well. Number one, they started driving up to the wall with ramps mounted on the back of trucks, literally driving over the wall. And then they've gone back to, again, the wall is basically Bronze Age technology, right? My people, I'm Chinese American. We have a long history with walls, and it's easy to develop countermeasures. So for this Bronze Age technology, traffickers adapted Roman era technology, catapults, or technically it's a trebuchet, use a counterweight, but they can fling giant packages of drugs over that wall. Right? And here's one that was found last year, is literally bolted onto the wall itself. And so what they do is they pull the string and down comes the arm. They put the drug package there and they literally fling it across the wall. But they've also innovated. You've probably seen t-shirt cannons at sports stadiums for events where they shoot out these t-shirts and goodies for the audience. Drug traffickers adapted that technology as well. So we had a compressed air cannon mounted in the back of pickup trucks that can pull up to the wall and launch bales over the wall. But since we're talking about Donald Trump and his issues, size matters. And yes, you can make it much bigger. So this cannon here can launch 100-pound bales. And it's literally comes out of the sunroof of a van using compressed air. And you can launch very large payloads over that wall. But it's not just going over the wall, it's going under the wall. So unless Trump wants to build a wall up to 100 feet deep, because that's how deep some of the deepest tunnels are, you're never going to stop this problem. We've discovered more than 100 of them along the southwest border. They crisscross our dual cities that are on both sides of that fence. And they only need to be a few kilometers or a few hundred yards long. They're very sophisticated. A lot of them have electricity, rail systems, ventilation, elevators, all kinds of sophisticated technologies. Here's one with, you can see a rail system there. And again, they can move lots of packages, not just drugs. but they can also move material south of the border. So returning, they can send guns, ammunition, repatriate cash, which is difficult to smuggle. Dogs are actually trained to sniff for cash going the other way. So those tunnels can work in both directions, and they can work 24/7 in theory once they're opened. In fact, there was a tunnel found in Tijuana a couple of years ago. They raided just before it opened, and they found 40 tons of marijuana on the Mexican side waiting to come over. So we're talking about a lot of volume. Now compare that to Trump's claim for a need for a desert wall along the, you know, our entire border. Migrants are not carrying drug packages. You know, that's not what's fueling our crisis. We're talking about moving drugs at the tonnage, at the ton level, not the kilo level. And so if you can imagine a migrant being forced by a coyote, a smuggler, to carry their water supply, their worldly possessions, how much more drugs can you possibly carry on your back on a very perilous journey that people don't want to make to begin with in these remote border areas? You can't carry enough water to get you across. And so unless we're talking about stopping tons of drugs, this is not an equation that's going to matter. And it's certainly not warranted, the $5 billion Trump is asking for, the $25 billion, many people think it will actually cost if he builds a wall. Some estimates have gone as high as $70 billion for a wall. Again, the countermeasures are too easy for drug traffickers to get around the wall. Here's one with a very sophisticated tunnel. Nice work here with the masonry. I think Trump would approve of the construction quality of this wall. But it's got a nice rail system, electricity, lighting, ventilation, all that stuff. But it's not just the land route. So there's always been the sea route. Right now, most of it is being smuggled from Central and South America up to Mexico or Guatemala and then through the border. But there's no reason they can't use it in the Atlantic and other places as well. But these technologies have been around for a long time. So in the old days, they used to use, smugglers would use fishing boats, and they might throw a few kilos of drugs underneath a shipment of fish or something smelly. But we got better at detecting that and inspecting those cargoes. So they went to faster speed boats, cigarette boats that could outrun the old Coast Guard speed boats. Then we got faster Coast Guard speed boats. We gave them helicopters with 50 caliber machine guns to shoot their engine blocks and different ways of stopping those boats. And then the traffickers for the past two decades or more actually have been using semi-submersibles. These are not full submarines. They stay mostly underwater, about 90% underwater. And you can see the conning tower staying above. And that's how they navigate and get air. These can carry up to 12 tons of drugs per run. And they're difficult to detect. During the day, they'll usually stay motionless. Sometimes they'll throw up tarp over themselves to blend in with the water, and they travel by night. As one DEA agent put it, you try finding something the size of a log floating in the Pacific Ocean. It's very, very difficult. Nonetheless, we've gotten better at detecting those. We can you know, detect the conning towers and interdict some of these shipments. Very rare, but does happen. And so we've captured some of these. This is the Colombian military, Colombian Navy has captured some of these semi-submersibles. You can see the size of this thing made out of fiberglass. These are custom made by drug traffickers. They hire very good engineers to do this construction. And in more recent years, they've actually gone and built proper submarines that can actually dive up to 50 feet underwater. This is a very troubling development, but it shows you how much money they have at their disposal and how much these drugs are worth, which warrants an explanation. These drugs aren't worth very much money to begin with. When we're talking about the war on drugs and all these various different substances, whether it's marijuana, cocaine, methamphetamines, heroin, these are basically minimally processed agricultural and chemical commodities that cost pennies to produce in a free market in the real world. There's no reason these drugs should be so expensive, but it's our policies of drug prohibition, the war on drugs, that makes these drugs so valuable. And one of the ways it does that is through escalating the risk premium that drug traffickers can charge. So as our drug warriors get tougher and tougher every year, as they vow, you know, we'll get them this time, we'll double the sentences, we'll put more patrols out. Well, the higher the risk to an individual drug trafficker, the higher the risk premium they can charge the next person down that smuggling chain. And so this commodity starts at a very low value in South America, And by the time it reaches the United States, it's snowballing in value. And the more difficult the border crossing, the more dangerous to the trafficker, the higher the prison sentence they may have to serve, or the higher the likelihood they'll get killed or caught, then the higher they can charge the next person in the smuggling chain.
That was San Ho Tree, a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and the director of their drug policy project. He was presenting a webinar on the drug war and the proposed U.S.-Mexico border wall. If you are on Twitter, you should be following San Ho. He is at San Ho Tree. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of drugwarfacts.org, and also at Doug McVeigh on Twitter. We just have time for this last segment. I was talking about marijuana recently with a good friend of mine, Anthony Taylor. Anthony is a longtime drug policy reformer, marijuana legalizer, and medical marijuana patient advocate. He's a co-founder of Compassionate Oregon and works as their legislative liaison. We spoke recently about marijuana legalization and how it's been working in Oregon, and about Compassionate Oregon's plans for this upcoming legislative session. So let's hear part of that conversation.
There's an oversupply, which means prices are way down, which helps the patient in the long run. The problem is none of these patients can find growers anymore, so they can't get their cannabis for free, so they're forced into these stores or into the black market to get their product. The stores are very expensive. I mean, you go into a store and you buy a half-gram cartridge right now and it costs you $50. The patient can't afford that if they're blowing through a couple of those every couple of days. Patients can't afford a 1-gram syringe of RSO that's $60 or $70 and they're using one of those a day. So the regulatory structure that has been put in place is not serving the patients very well. There's lots of stuff available, but if you're buying it in the stores, it's out of the price range for most patients. 53% of all our patients qualify for a reduced fee on their cards. So you can see that the problems facing the patients are not so much related to access, but cost. And then the final aspect of what patients have to deal with, that the guy stopping in on a Friday night to pick up his ounce for the weekend is never going to even think about, because he'd never have to go to the doctor with THC in his system. Where a patient that's using cannabis every day has THC in their system at levels that most consumers would never have, and they can suffer discrimination at the hands of the standardized medical care community, and that's the biggest problem facing patients. Patients that are drug tested for a legal substance. Patients that are fired for having a legal substance in their system. Patients that are suffering chronic pain, whose doctors tell them no, they cannot have an opioid because they have a medical marijuana card. Patients that want to be daycare providers that can't even apply for a daycare provider certificate because they have a medical marijuana card. These are issues facing patients that are never addressed in any of the legalization conversations. As we saw in 2015, when the legislature came in, the first thing they started doing was try to ratchet down the amount of cannabis being produced by the OMMP growers, because at that time, the first year that OLPC growers harvested, they harvested 1.5 million pounds of wet cannabis. It turned into several hundred thousand pounds of cannabis, and we're all talking about that, but what we're not talking about is at the same time, the medical growers were producing virtually the same amount of cannabis. That has been ratcheted down now, and that, of course, affects patients, but if a patient can't find a grower, and the growers won't do it because it's too expensive, or the rules are too burdensome or change too often, you got a situation where now the state has to step in and figure out how to subsidize the cost of these medicines for these patients. Well, one of the first things that our organization, my organization, Compassionate Oregon, is trying to do is address the oversupply issue by allowing the OMMP growers to transfer out to any patient that they have a personal agreement with. Right now, they're only allowed to transfer to patients that are actually registered at the grow sites. The Oregon Liquor Control Commission does not have that requirement. It should be the same for the medical growers. This will help bring down some of those inventory levels. The other thing we're trying to do is, through subsidization, give relief to those medical growers for the annual metric user fees and for some relief in the purchase of the state physicians that can sign a attending physician statement to qualify for an Oregon medical marijuana card, as well as eliminating the petitioning process for getting a condition added and allowing the doctors the ability to recommend cannabis and to qualify for a patient card on for something that's not on the list. One other thing we're trying to get done, this is a trickier one and it's a huge lift, is to exempt medical patients and growers from the restrictions on outdoor cultivation within city limits in cities like Grants Pass and Medford. Right now, a patient cannot, no one can cultivate cannabis outside within those city limits. And that's an unfair burden on patients. So we're going to see what we can do there. And that's about it. The report out of the Cannabis Commission goes directly to the chairs of the Judiciary and Healthcare Committees. And we have gotten support from all of those chairs to take a look at it. And I know that Senate Judiciary is very interested in introducing the one for creating the revenue and some of the other issues that the Cannabis Commission has recommended. So it's going to be a busy session for Compassionate Oregon. It's going to be a very busy and opportune session for patients. So that's one thing I would say is patients really stay in touch with what's going on in the legislature, because bills are starting to come out already, and we'll see how ours come out, and if you like them, support them, and make sure that your representatives, your own representatives and senators, are aware of your concerns and the support or not support. So the Oregon Cannabis Commission can be followed through the Oregon Health Authority website. There's a direct link to the commission, all the typical stuff, the agendas, the meetings, the minutes, all that sort of stuff can be found there, who's on the commission, what their agendas are and all that sort of stuff. And that's the best place to find it. And we're going to be, some of our recommendations out of our report that was required, that will be submitted sometime to the legislature here in the next couple of weeks, outlines our recommendations, provides the subcommittee reports, as well as the general recommendations. And some of those, I think, will pretty easily become legislation or amendments to existing legislation. So that's the place to follow the Cannabis Commission, is at the Oregon Health Authority website.
That was a conversation with Anthony Taylor, co-founder and legislative liaison at Compassionate Oregon, a medical marijuana patient advocacy organization. We were talking about the state of legal marijuana in Oregon and Compassionate Oregon's plans for the upcoming legislative session. And that's it for this week. Thank you for joining us. You have been listening to Century of Lies. Century of Lies is a production of the Drug Truth Network for the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network on the web at drugtruth.net. For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.